The E-Commerce Fuel Podcast is sponsored by Klaviyo. If you're working around the clock to build your e-commerce business, you need an e-commerce specific marketing platform that works just as hard as you do. That means you need Klaviyo. With Klaviyo, you'll delight customers and drive revenue at the same time with personalized email and SMS marketing campaigns that you can design and send in minutes without an IT degree. It's by far the most popular email marketing tool in our private community of 7- and 8-figure e-commerce store owners because it's got incredibly advanced and powerful segmentation features that help you make more money. To get started for free and to learn more, check them out at klaviyo.com/ECF. That's klaviyo.com/ECF. The E-Commerce Fuel Podcast is brought to you by One Click Upsell by Zipify Apps. You probably know there's three ways to make more money from your store. You can get more traffic, you can increase the size of the orders you get, or you can increase the number of people that convert on your site. You're probably spending time on traffic, almost certainly. You may have spent time with conversion rate optimization, but when's the last time, honestly, you tried to increase that cart size? Well, one-click upsell makes it incredibly easy to offer powerful targeted upsells to your customers. They've generated over $150 million in additional revenue for store owners, just like you. And over 16% of people who get offered an upsell actually take you up on it. It's really powerful. Their entire system is built into Shopify's native checkout, so it's rock solid and secure. And it's built by Ezra Firestone and his team. Ezra, you may know, good friend of mine. He's been in the e-commerce game for a long time. He uses this on his own 8-figure stores. He's in the trenches and he knows it works. So if you want to actually start working on a third of your business that you've been neglecting, increasing that cart size, check him out today at ecommercefuel.com/upsell. Hey, it's Andrew here, and welcome to the E-Commerce Fuel Podcast, a show dedicated to helping 7-figure-plus e-commerce brands build incredible businesses and amazing lives. And today on the show, I'm joined by Deanne and Garrett Ackerson, who are the co-founders of KindredBravely.com. It's a company that sells nursing clothing, nursing bras, nursing apparel, apparel for mothers, among other things. Incredibly successful business and story. Garrett and Deanne started it back in 2013 or 14, won the 2015 Shopify Build a Business contest. And about 5 years later, 6 years later, rather, just sold a large stake in it to a private equity company. And you know, they're doing tens of millions of dollars a year in revenue. Lots of good stuff to dig into there. Incredibly successful business story, but that's not what I wanted to focus on in this episode. I wanted to talk about something that doesn't get discussed a whole ton, and that is, how do you build a business, a meaningful business, one that is growing insanely quickly, like the one that they have, with juggling raising small children? Both of those endeavors in their own right are insanely difficult, and you put them together, and if you're not being really intentional about how you're doing it, you ever played a video game where it goes to just, yeah, there's the difficulty level, the insanity mode? That's kind of what I envision this being like. And having children of my own, I have a small sense into what this looks like, although I don't think I had quite the bandwidth issues that Garrett and Deanne did. Anyway, we talk about this pretty candidly, and I really appreciate them coming on, and they talk about the good, the bad, the ugly, the things they're glad they did, the things they really regret they did, some great advice they got. We just dive into the weeds on this, as well as covering some of the cool parts about their business journey as well. So hope you enjoy it, and let's go ahead and dive right into my discussion with Garrett and Deanne. Deanne and Garrett, welcome to the show. Good to have you.
Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, excited to dive into your story and talk about it maybe from a slightly different perspective. Before we jump in, though, we're going to get into the whole story of the business, but you guys are fresh off of a sale of a large portion of the business to a private equity firm, which I was joking with Garrett earlier, is never makes anybody's top 5 life experiences in terms of just enjoyment and, you know, lack relaxation. So congratulations on getting that done and kind of having it in the rearview mirror, and excited for you guys going ahead. That's a huge moment in your journey.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, it was definitely a lot of work.
I bet. How are you guys feeling right now, just in terms of mental space shape? When you wake up in the morning, is it just, how are you guys from a mental perspective right now, being on the back end of this?
I would say, well, speaking for me, I'm feeling better this week since it's going on a week now since we closed. Yeah, certainly the first few days after the close was more exhaustion than elation, I think.
Yeah, it's starting to sink in now, and I think the recovery is nearly through. But a solid weekend of sleep and definitely was needed after the arduous process.
Sleep and hydration and recovery. It's like running a marathon, it sounds like.
It did. There were times, and Garrett and I have both run marathons, and it's kind of the same. Like, it's the mental headspace of, okay, like, we just keep going. There's a new request list today. Like, we just keep going. Whatever's needed, you know, you just do what you need to do to get through that day.
Yeah, I think there were over 1,000 lines of, like, data that we had to submit, different documents and requests.
That's horrible. And trying to do this in a way that your team probably doesn't worry them. And that's rough. Well, congratulations. And we're going to get into the business story and some parts of the deal and a little bit later, but I'd love to approach this from a slightly different angle. You guys both have children. I've got 3 kids of my own. And I feel like it's fairly rare that people talk about what it's like building a business, especially a high growth business such as yours, with children, especially with young children, because building a business with kids, especially when they're, you know, 8 and under or 10 and under, or even younger, is a completely different animal from doing it without kids, because just kids are wonderful, but they also require an insane amount of work and time and commitment. So yeah, I want to dive into how you balance family and the company and the good and the bad and the hard trade-offs and things like that. So maybe to frame things up for people, can you give us a sense of how many kids you have now in 2021 and their ages, and then how many kids you had in their ages, back when you started the business in, I think, 2014, 15?
So we have 2 boys, and they are currently 7 and 9. And when we started the business, they were 1 and 3. And it's really impossible to separate this business from our children, because it directly came out of my need for better nursing pajamas when our youngest was 1. So, like, the business would not have been born without the children. would have been true. Easier to build without children, no doubt, to your point, but it's totally impossible to separate this business from children and the life space of all other women who are going through that transition of having children.
Yeah. We jokingly refer to Kinder Bravely as our third child.
Third and fourth and fifth child, children.
Yeah, pretty much.
Starting a business 1 and 3 with kids that are 1 and 3, how hard, just even apart from the business aspect, I love my children dearly, but when we had our second and that period of 1 and 3, that was thinking back on that time, that was one of the harder, if not kind of the hardest points in my time trying to balance being a father, running a business. And it was just tough. You have so many, it was a really difficult time. And granted, I say this as someone who has had a very good life, so a huge caveat, but it was, probably the hardest time in my very easy life. I'll kind of a little side fetch. I think your 30s is probably one of, I think it's been the hardest decade of my life, again, for easy life, just because you're trying to do it. You've got a lot of times, if you're having a family, you've got really young kids, you're trying to balance those, you're trying to balance your business. So from each of you guys, even apart from the business, just how did you guys deal with, and how hard was kind of having 2 young kids in the house like that, even professional ambition aside? Because I don't feel like people talk about that very much. Or I feel like a lot of times people are like, oh, it's wonderful, and here's the Instagram, and we're just so filled with joy, and you are. But man, it's like, it's also, it's really tough.
It is, yeah. For me, prior to starting Kinder Bravely, I was running a digital marketing agency. And part of wanting to start something else and something in the, direct to consumer space was actually wanting more work-life balance. I was just working crazy hours and going into the office. So I knew I wanted to spend more time with our boys and not go into an office. Ironically, that I don't know how that thinking worked out, but it was the impetus, or part of the impetus, for wanting to do something different. So it was a mix. I continued to run that other company and just work on this business in the evenings the first year. So it was certainly a lot of long days and evenings after the kids were asleep. But I think year 2 was actually really nice. In 2016, we spent a month with both boys in China, and we've always been remote. So we were both working from home. It was just the two of us, and we were able by year two to be full-time in the business. And then year two, we also hired three team members. So I kind of felt like it went through stages. I think that first year was probably the most demanding. And then the second year, I think being able to flex your schedule, it was really rewarding to just spend more time with the boys and be home for, you know, lunch and dinner and
play with them. There certainly wasn't less working going on, but it was more on our schedule. And there's a bit of, you know, with that power comes, there are trade-offs, but I think overall it's worth it. I have an early memory when the boys were like, maybe they were probably just past 1 and 3. And I was just recently looking through, I have this little notebook called Funny Things That the Kids Have Said. And I had written down that when Garrett was leaving for work to go to that development agency he was mentioning, the three-year-old would tell the one-year-old who was crying because he didn't want daddy to leave, it's okay, daddy has to go to work, because if daddy doesn't go to work, then we don't get money. And if we don't get money, then we die. So daddy has to go to work. So it was like this little coping mechanism that he had come up with, like, daddy has to go to work. And I guess it's a good thing, because otherwise we would die. And it was like, looking back on that quote reminded me of how much we wanted something different at the beginning. Like, we didn't want to be that family where daddy left every morning early at like 7 o'clock and got back at, you know, 6:30 or 7 o'clock at night. And kids go to bed early, you know, they're going to bed at 7 o'clock. So we just didn't want that. It was, you know, Garrett and I have always had a really good, like, balanced marriage and partnership. And that was the first time in our life where, like, I was staying home, he was working long hours, and it was really hard on our family. Like, we just didn't get the spaces that we were in. And as soon as we stepped into, like, making something our own again, even though the hours were just as long and perhaps even more grueling, it worked for our family. We were working on something together. We were able to flex even a couple hours to be able to, you know, enjoy the time when little tiny kids are up and awake and happy, because little kids aren't happy in the evening at like 6 and 7 o'clock. And it just felt worth it, even though it was really hard in the beginning. It still felt worth it.
It's funny, two things I massively related to there. You talk about kids. And for one thing I've changed, I think I mentioned this to you before we started recording, this, at least the last 3 or 4 months, I started Tuesdays, Thursdays, spending about an hour and a half with each of my girls in the morning, like carving out time from my work. Because for a long time, I was like, hey, my mornings are, it's when I'm super like on point, and it's when I'm focused and where I can get the most done. And like, that's my business time. I was very protective of that, and still fairly am. But I realized I'd come home at 6 and like the kids would be fighting and they're tired at the end of a long day. And over time, I realized like they're probably seeing me at my most tired, where my energy's gone. And I'm seeing them when they're tired and grumpy. And so the difference, if you can, as a parent, carving out some of that morning time versus evening time a little bit, like it's huge. I've noticed it's just such a better, there's such a massive difference. And the thing that you said about, I've had similar conversations with my kids too. And they're like, why are you going to work? Why do you work so much? And I'm like, well, you know, because so we have money and we can do this and that. And like, well, what happened if you didn't? And then I think I said something hyperbolic, like, well, we wouldn't have money and we wouldn't be able to eat. And do you want to eat? And which is way over the top. And for me, at one point, I was like, it made me think, I was like, you know, I probably could take a day or two off without the family starving. Or you think about, like, is it really about food? Is it really survival? Or is it because I want to be able to do X, Y, and Z, or I want, you know, it kind of makes you also think about how you're, when you have that kind of conversation, when your kids are so, look at it in such stark terms, perhaps because I framed it for them that way unfairly, makes you be like, am I really doing this because we can eat? Or should I do a better job of prioritizing my time?
The kids ask us, in fact, I think it was our youngest asked recently, like, why do you work all the time, Dad? Why do you work so much? I think it's easy to default into that mode, at least for me. It's rewarding and it's easy.
Yeah, quite frankly, it's easier than parenting a lot of times.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, it's if you have, you know, multiple kids and it's true. It can be, especially if you're doing it, you know, day in and day out, like sometimes just getting getting on your laptop and hammering stuff out can be way, way less mentally exhausting. I want to focus on some of the things you guys did in terms of balance. And obviously you guys, you know, you mentioned changing, Garrett, you left your job and started doing this. And even though you're working a lot, the flexibility was huge. What were some of the things that you did or spent money on or prioritized that looking back, you're really glad that you did that allowed you to both grow the business and be, you know, parent fairly well or parent really well, and not go, you know, be able to balance that? So certain things that you did, things you spent money on, things you prioritized, what did you do really well that you look back and said, I'm so glad we did this. This helped us get through this. What were those things?
Well, I think the first thing that comes to mind for me is what we didn't do well. And so we did fall into this kind of stage or trap, which I think a lot of people could probably relate to, of just working all the time. If you're working on your own company, and particularly if your spouse is your partner, it's just really easy to be like the default mode is you're always on, always working on the business. And we have an amazing counselor, therapist. So spending money on her, I would say, was amazing.
Yeah.
Well spent. And one tool or piece of advice she gave us, she said, look, you are not going to be able to not work on your business. Like, it's clear that's just not going to happen. So why don't you just set do not work time? Because clearly just setting work time like 9 to 5 isn't practical. It's not going to work. You're a high growth company. You're growing rapidly. It's just going to eat up all your time. So just set do not work hours. And for Deanna and I think that was one of the early key pieces of advice from her, among a myriad of other amazing pieces of advice and just, you know, marital help overall, relationship advice and help. But that one in particular really helped us. We printed it out and posted it on the, you know, home office door, do not work hours.
And it wasn't that many. It was like dinner time each night, maybe from like 5:30 to 7:30, one date night a week, which is when we went to see our counselor sometimes, and sometimes we went to dinner, and then one weekend day. For me, it was Friday night to Saturday night. And then the rest of the time was fair game. So don't get mad if I'm in the office on a Sunday working because I need to, or I'm up and it's 4 o'clock in the morning and I'm pounding away at work. It was, you know, just pick a few hours, protect them, and don't worry about all the rest.
And were you both pretty good about sticking to those do not work hours? How well did you do in abiding by them?
I'd give this a B. What would you say?
B plus. We did well. It worked.
Yeah. I mean, obviously there were a few times when something would come up and it would get squashed, but it was pretty good.
And we would hold each other accountable. Like, hey, no, kind of like the, hey, no phones at the dinner table. I don't know if your family also has, you know, that rule, but it was like, hey, no working right now.
It was basically don't work from, you know, you come to the dinner table until the kids are asleep, which was essentially like a 2-hour period in the evenings. Not a huge ask, but it did help.
There's something too about printing something out and putting it up in your home where you see it regularly that helps a lot with that. Because then if you're not doing it, then you feel like you feel a big disconnect or, yeah, to have to face that on a regular basis. It's small, but it's a nice hack.
Yeah, it gives you permission to not work. And that being said, we've always co-parented and in a way where when one of us was on, the other was off. So while Deanne was on with the kids, I would be working, and then we'd often swap and I'd be on with the kids and Deanne would be working.
And I think the kids themselves, especially when they're very young, do help you to not go crazy. Because when you're with them, you can't be thinking about work. You know, when you have small children, like, you know, under age 4, you're playing trucks with them and building trains and you're, you know, walking to the park and riding scoot bikes. And you're so in the moment with them that it's almost impossible to be thinking about work at the same time. I've actually struggled with that more as they've gotten older and they've both been in school for the last couple, well, I say school. Barring COVID, they did go to school for a while, and I found it easier to sort of multitask, like the kids are home from school, but let me go ahead and try to get some work done. And I actually kind of miss the urgency with which small children really demand your presence, because I never try to schedule my time that I'm the primary caregiver and also trying to work at the same time, because it really robs the joy of both experiences, which on their own are both incredible. So I think children help you to really stay present, stay in the moment, stay focused, which I kind of actually miss that phase of parenting.
Garrett, do you feel the same way? Was it easier for you to be present with your kids when they were younger?
Yeah, for sure. I think it's easy for me to be single task oriented. So turning off work and being present, assuming my phone is not on my body anywhere, not in my pocket, but set it on a shelf somewhere, that seems to help as well. But, spending the afternoon at the beach, we live, a couple blocks from the beach here, or spending time playing Legos, their favorite thing to do. It's easy to be in the moment.
Oh, Legos are such a wonderful invention.
Amazing. Yeah, they are.
Love those things. Great. So the no work hours, what else did you do well or spend money on or prioritize? You mentioned that that counselor you had some really other great advice. Any of those other tips or things that worked well for you, either on the marriage front or on the parenting front that you guys are willing to share?
I think so. One tip that I really remember that I think would help a lot of parents out that she mentioned is that a lot of our struggles that we had, that they really flare up around parenting. And I think for a lot of people, they do. It comes back to control. And so when you look at a certain situation, instead of trying to control it and saying, no, it has to be this way, and the other person saying, no, it has to be that way, approach the situation she really helped me to open my eyes and realize that Garrett and I were both approaching certain situations by wanting what's best for our children. And while that looked different for each of us, when we could back up like half a step and say, oh, the reason Garrett wants this is because this is how he views it for our children. And Garrett could do the same and say, oh, the reason Deanne wants it this way is because this is how, she views this situation for our children. And when we could just back up that half step and get out of just the control, like gridlock kind of reaction and say, we each are trying to do what we think is best for our children, then it just makes the whole situation so much less full of conflict, and it's easier to navigate, and it just takes a lot of the stress out of the situation and the emotion out of it.
When you both realize you're trying to get to the same place, just maybe slightly different paths.
Yeah. Like there's this classic fight we used to have over sunblock where I would want to put sunblock on the kids religiously between the hours of like 11 and 3, because we live in San Diego, it's pretty sunny. And Garrett would want them to have time without sunblock to get their vitamin D. And so when we were able to like step back from that and realize that we're both trying to get what's best for our children, i.e. not burn and have skin cancer later, but also not be vitamin D deficient, we were able to like come back and not just fight over like, has the sunblock been put on? No, I'm not going to put on sunblock. Yes, you need to. Like, it was such a silly fight. And that has become representative for a lot of other, struggles that we had as, young evolving parents. So we each were trying to do what was best for our children, but from a slightly different point of view.
I'm just curious, what did you guys end up deciding on the sunblock? How did you end up kind of navigating that?
So I think the counselor actually recommended that we have certain days where like it's mom's decision day and, other days when it's dad's decision day. And on certain things like sunblock, I think we agreed to like 15 or 20 minutes of core time and then the sunblock goes on. So it's compromise really. But for things that don't matter, like, maybe sunburn, if it was dad's decision day all day, you could say, well, maybe they're going to get burned. So that's not a great example. But if it was other things where it truly doesn't matter, then there were certain days where it was just, okay, it's dad's decision day today. And, unless there's like a health and safety issue involved, like whatever he says, it's his decision day today. And then I would also have decision days and
pizza and ice cream for dinner. Right, Garrett?
Yep. It actually reminds me, I just finished reading Essentialism and there was a quote in there, almost everything doesn't matter.
Yeah, that's a good one.
And it's true. I do think it's been certainly that period, not so much in the last year, but the first four, there was a good 4 years there. Those were the hardest years on our marriage.
Right. Because I think you're renegotiating everything, just like when you first get married. And for us, you know, kids, we didn't have kids till 10 years later. So it's almost like a brand new renegotiation of everything. You know, the household chores, there's a lot more to do once kids are there.
And the business.
And the business. And it was all happening at once. You know, who's doing what in the business? Who's doing what for the kids?
Yeah. And it's, I think it's easy too, as a, with spouses, it's, I think this just goes for life or anything, but you know what's going on in your life. And you guys probably have a better sense given that you're both, you know, both parent, like parenting and business full time. But especially if you have like, you know, if two people are working or one's staying home and one's working and you don't see each other all day, like it's, I think it's easy to be like, oh, I've done all of this stuff. I know what's going on in my life and I'm exhausted. And, or you see the things that your spouse isn't doing that you feel like they should, but you don't necessarily know all the stuff that they're doing that you don't see. I think it's easy to not have full empathy for how hard they're working despite the stuff that you're doing as well. What do you regret not doing or wish you had done differently from pairing or family perspective? You gave us a couple of really good tips on like the thinking about the different how to parent, kind of some of those great tips and also the no working hours. But what do you look back and say, I wish if we could go back and wave the magic wand, I would have done this differently, especially from a family and a parenting perspective.
For me, one thing I've been working on consistently is not letting my frustration, anger, different expectations, I guess, flow over into family life. So that's something, it's not, at least for me personally, it's been a struggle. It's not easy. If I could wave a magic wand, it would be not letting that flow over into our relationship, Dan and I's relationship, or kids, when I'm just frustrated to no end and it boils over into family life. And you feel it, I think, you know, running a company is high stress and at the same time, you're used to being able to call all the shots and say, you know, this is what we're going to do. This is how it's going to work. That just does not work in family life.
Yeah, agreed.
I would say I really tried to bring more fun into our family a few years ago. In fact, I had a friend who's also an artist. She like lettered this gorgeous chalk drawing in the boys' room, which was the office at the time. So we had this beautiful lettered board that said, he said 2016, the year of fun, or 2017, the year of fun. Because we said, okay, 2016 was all about getting stuff done. Now 2017 is going to be the year of fun. And she put all these whimsical little illustrations of things that reminded me of fun times I had had. And I was like, I really want to have more fun this year. And I got to be honest, I don't think I had any more fun that year than the year prior, because I am just really good at getting things done. And I'm really bad at fun. And so I wish, and I got to a place where I figured out that fun for me still has to be scheduled. Pre-COVID, we kind of had this routine where we would every 4 or 6 weeks, we would block off a weekend on the calendar, like do not let anything creep into it. And we were taking the kids somewhere fun, just overnight for one night, like a fun hotel in San Diego that had a water slide or something like that, or camping. I wish that I had done more fun earlier on. You know, I know people that are just so good about playing dance music in their house and the whole family just like dancing around. And I'm not really good at spontaneous fun. I had gotten better at some planned fun, and then COVID hit and we haven't really got back into it. But I do wish, and I regret not having a little more fun during, especially 2017, 18, those years.
Hey, Andrew here with a little aside. If you're listening, you're obviously interested in e-commerce. And so I want to make sure you know about our private community for 7- and 8-figure e-commerce brands at E-Commerce Fuel. And the secret sauce, like you might guess, is it's limited to people who own stores, who are in the trenches, practitioners doing this stuff. It's a very curated community, which has three big benefits. First, it means everyone inside can help get fast, on-point answers to your most important questions. if you're trying to decide if SMS is a tool worth rolling out, if you just got suspended on Amazon, if you're trying to hire a director of e-commerce, these are all things that either people have experience with or have gone through in the forums. And if you post and ask questions, you'll get answers within hours, sometimes even minutes, as well as being able to tap into close to a decade of archive discussions. So you get a lot of insights, fast answers to pressing questions. You get to plug into an amazing network of over 1,100 experienced e-commerce entrepreneurs. So you can reach out to people. If you're in e-commerce fuel, our members are incredibly giving and generous. And so if you want to reach out to someone with expertise, oftentimes they'd be happy to share what they know. If you're, you know, traveling, hopefully when traveling is a common thing again, a lot of our members would hit in the city, you know, DC, Dallas, Sydney, Australia, you know, London, wherever it is, and be able to have someone on the ground you can connect with, or maybe grab a beer with. It's an amazing network. And then finally, we've got a huge user-generated review library with over 10,000 reviews on agencies, software, e-commerce software that you can tap into, avoid costly hiring and software mistakes. Nothing is worse than spending 3 months with an agency to onboard, only to find out that a bunch of people already tried them and they were horrible and they wasted a bunch of your money and your life. So those are the kind of things you can avoid tapping into the unbiased reviews and experiences of our members with our software directory. So if any of this sounds interesting to you, you should join us at ecommercefuel.com. You can learn more. You can apply for membership there. We also have a 5x ROI guarantee. If you own a 7 or 8 figure brand and your membership fees for our community don't pay for themselves at least 5 times over the course of the first year, we'll refund it completely as well as send you $1,000 just for the wasted time. So ecommercefuel.com, check it out. We'd love to have you apply and potentially join the community. All right, back to the discussion. How much do you get your kids involved in the business? I think I was reading and prepping for this. I can't remember which one it was that mentioned it, but one time you went to China and you took your kids along to visit suppliers. And I think they were pretty young at the time, like, you know, 1 or 2 or 2 and 4. And the anecdote I was remembering resulted in you guys trekking across some amusement park in like 95 degree weather and 90% humidity. It was just miserable, which maybe is not the best memory to recall for this. But I mean, obviously you took your kids to China for a supplier trip, which is, I don't think most people heading over to China are doing, which is really cool. How much have they been involved, or at least kind of just along for the ride with you with those kind of things? Has that been something you've tried to do? Does it just happen that way out of pure essential, you know, purely because you had to, is essential? Or do you intentionally try to work them into the business when you can?
Well, the trip to China was definitely like, they just had to come along, and I wouldn't have thought of leaving them for more than a couple of days at that age. They were 2 and 4, and my 2-year-old was still breastfeeding, so it wasn't an option to leave the kids. But I think they're around, you know. Even when they started school, they've been in a charter school where they're homeschooling 3 days a week, and they go to track 2 days a week. So naturally, they are around a lot. I don't make a concerted effort to, you know, bring them in and show them what I'm doing. Although our older son is very entrepreneurial and quite interested in how the business works, you know, from like a numbers perspective, like what do you do with all the money that you get and where does it go and why don't you get to spend it all? So, you know, we definitely have the chance to have conversations with him now that he's 9, almost 10. But I think it's more a byproduct. I never like thought, oh, Garrett, let's make sure we involve our kids in our business, right?
Yeah, I would agree. I think we probably could have brought them in more, at least more recently. I think there have been more opportunities now, to your point, now that Enoch's older and he's more interested in involving him more. But it wasn't conscious, to your point. It was just a byproduct of life at the time, running a business and parenting.
And we didn't have an office. You know, we worked remote until 2018 is when we got our first warehouse and office. So, I mean, they were part of it. Production happened in one of the 3 very small rooms of our old 1950s house. So they were definitely a part of it. They were touching all the fabrics and, you know, into everything.
Yeah, that's actually a good segue for, I'd love to hear how you guys get, and you touched on this a little bit earlier, kind of tag teaming, you know, one of you will watch kids while the other one works, but how do you do that from up until 2018? How do you do that working from home? Because there's there's so much value in working from home, but I feel like the trick is having a very dedicated workspace. Like for in a transition right now, and we're for, you know, a couple of years had a great kind of detached studio to work at from home, which was the, in my opinion, the absolute best of both worlds, because you have a little separation where you can work. There's some noise barrier. It's far enough away that you can go and kind of retreat and work when needed, but it's 15 seconds from the family, from the house, for, you know, there's zero commute. It's perfect. But it's, you know, that's kind of an ideal setup. How do you guys get work done effectively? Did you have obviously you had a home office, but did you have really strict rules with your kids? Was it separated? Was it inside the house? Like, how did you guys, what rules did you have in place to be able to really crank on stuff when you needed to without, you know, kids coming in and bombing conference calls and things like that?
Well, first of all, they have bombed conference calls.
BBC style. You guys have seen that, right?
Yes.
Oh, best video of all time. We'll post it up in the show notes if you haven't seen it. So.
You brought back a memory that I almost forgot from a couple of years ago when I was trying to do a Facebook Live with two other team members who were also dialing in remote. And I had told my kids, like, okay, mommy has to work. And it was like 6 o'clock at night, so a really unusual hour. And I think Garrett, I don't remember, you had a work dinner that night. It was one of those weird times where I was trying to just do a quick, like 15 minute Facebook Live. And I think I put them on iPads and they were feeding their pet
bearded dragon.
And if you know anything about bearded dragons, they eat mostly live insects. And so I just closed the door. I'm like welcoming everyone to Facebook Live. I've literally just said, you know, welcome, you know, we're going to be talking about such and such. And there's this like pounding on the door. And at first I try to ignore it. And then he opens the door. He goes, mommy, mommy, come quick. Ruffles choking. And so here I am on Facebook Live trying to figure out like, what do I do? And, you know, of course I flubbed it. And, but yes, the whole, like, it would have been lovely to have a studio outside of the house. And no, we just have one office in the house. It does have a closing door, so you can close the door. And, you know, we've done all the tricks by like trying to make sure that the kids know, okay, I'm in a meeting. Don't, you know, ask daddy if you need anything right now. Mommy's working. We'll stuff the doors with blankets to try to dampen the noise. No, it does mix. It is not perfectly clean for sure.
That's amazing. Did the pet survive?
Is the he pet okay? Was actually totally fine. Ruffle just got really overzealous. I think on some kind of, it was a cricket, right? I can't even remember. Just some grub, and took a few attempts to get it down the old hatch, but Ruffle was just fine.
If that Facebook Live is recorded somewhere, I'm going to go try to dig it up. It sounds really, really fun to watch, actually.
It probably is. Everything online lives forever now, unfortunately.
Yeah. Finally, kind of one thing I also want to touch on is schooling. You have a really interesting setup with your kids, where, like you mentioned earlier, they're homeschooled 3 days a week. They go to track. And when you say track, at first I thought you meant like track and field, like running. But do you mean track as in like in the classroom for 2 days a week?
Yeah, just like a normal classroom with 20 kids and a teacher.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. And how does that work? Because I feel like I've thought about this. I think there's a lot of benefits to both homeschooling, also to traditional school. It seems like a really good mix for a lot of different reasons. And I'd love to hear, yeah, just your guys', you know, pre-COVID, you also mentioned that this is, I think you said that, I think your exact words were, this was the ideal setup pre-COVID. But yeah, share a little bit about that, like your thoughts on schooling with how that also blends in with, you know, running a business, running a really fast growing, busy business at home. How does that, what are your thoughts on the setup you have now and why do you like it so much?
This goes back to, you know, our earlier intention of being, you know, home more with our kids, more of that time spent, in particular when they were younger with them. And both Deanna and I actually were teachers in a prior life. I was right out of college for a few years before getting my MBA and then starting a series of companies. And then Deanne, this was Deanne's first venture, our first one together. So I think we both felt confident that we could educate our kids. So that part, I think, was part of it. And then the other piece was we just felt it was important for them to have that time to learn and explore. And I think it's so often that, unfortunately, education beats the curiosity out of kids or that desire to learn. And it just worked for our schedule, or we made it work, I should say.
Yeah. And, you know, I was a high school math teacher for, I think, 11 years. And the joy that I got from watching other people learn, I didn't want, selfishly, I didn't want to just give that over to another teacher. Like, I really wanted to watch my children learn. And it brought me a lot of joy. And so we found a school, a charter school that worked. You know, I also wanted them to have socialization too. And so those 2 days when they were with their classmates, I felt were really important. And that gave us focused time to work together, to attend meetings together. Because yeah, when you're building a business, you can't just always tag team. You have to work together with your co-founder too.
Is the charter school you guys are a part of, is it local just to the San Diego area, or is it kind of a national organization that
no,
other people?
It's just in San Diego County.
It is. Okay. Shoot. So we'll have to move to San Diego is what you're saying. Yeah. It sounds like an ideal combination. Well, thank you for being so candid on the parenting front. And I mean, it's a lot of people go through this, not many people talk about it. So thank you for being so honest and yeah, forthcoming. I think it's super helpful and interesting and, you know, kind of constructive for me to hear. And I think a lot of other people as well. I'd love to touch on a few of the kind of the traditional kind of business side of the story as well, because it's really interesting. And you already mentioned how the business kind of, I kind of gave an intro at the top about the product line that you sell and the background, but you kind of mentioned it came out of having your children and seeing the need for the products that you guys sell. And you grew incredibly fast starting out. Like, I mean, you started in 2015, is that right?
Yeah, 2015.
2015 won the Shopify Build a Business contest. And what did you do that first year in revenue? And then this last, you know, when you just sold, where were you guys at? So people can maybe get a sense of the growth arc over the last 6 years or so.
Sure. We started in 2015 and we started with one pair of pajamas in black and 4 sizes. And that year, that product launched, we launched on Shopify and Amazon at the same time. Although we just focused on Amazon sales to start with. And that was in June 6th was when we got our first sale. And the first year, I think we did about 127,000, given it was a partial year. And that was 99% on Amazon. But December of 2016, January of 2017, and I think the Shopify Build a Bigger Business competition ran like February through April.
A little longer.
Yeah. And that's when we were really ramping up spend on Facebook and Google and hired a number of team members just focused. I think we brought on in that first quarter, like 6 new team members, all focused on social and paid to build out Shopify. So that year,
I think it's just under 5 million.
Under 5 million in 2017, yeah, just under. And then 2018, we almost doubled again. We did just under 10 million, right around 9. 2018, we were number 20 on the Inc. 5000. We won that year.
Isn't that 2019?
No, you get the award in 2019.
Okay.
And then 2019, we slowed down mainly on purpose because 2018 was actually a really rough year for us. We had 5 negative months that year, which is the first time ever we were 100% bootstrapped. So we say 2018 was our most stressful year. 2020 had nothing on 2018.
Even with all the deal stuff.
Yeah. And then 2020, we doubled again. 2020 revenue came in right around 30. I think just under 30.
Wow. So zero to 30 in you know, just under six years, about 5-ish years. So yeah, I love also how that even 5 years later, you remember the exact date that you got your first sale. But that makes me smile because I it's a wonderful feeling. It gets burned into your brain.
Everybody remembers their first sale. I remember I looked at Gary, I said, hey, did you give away any promo codes? This was back when you could give away something for a review in those days of Amazon. He said, no, I didn't give any away. I said, really? I didn't either. Someone bought a pair of pajamas? How'd they even find them?
Oh, it's amazing. Such a good feeling. Well, you mentioned you pivoted from Amazon to Shopify, you know, after, you know, a year, year and a half-ish on Amazon. And obviously it's been a little while, but that is a hard transition for people to make. I mean, Amazon is, it's got the, you know, the captive audience. It's such an easier platform. It's not easy, but easier platform relative to Shopify to scale up. So what did you guys focus on? What did you do to focus on building the off Amazon brand that you think worked well? And granted, again, it's been a few years, but I think a lot of the high level concepts are probably going to be pretty similar. What did you guys, any tips for people who are trying to make that transition on how to do it well? Cause it's a tough one.
It is tough. And I think had we tried to do Amazon and Shopify simultaneously, we would not have succeeded. Much easier to, you know, do the one thing and topple, you know, that first domino, which for us was Amazon. And I think at that time when we made the switch, Amazon was probably doing about 250,000 a month. And so it was, and we still had a relatively small team and we had a good brand. So I think part of it starts off with, I feel like in the beginning, we were intentional about our branding. It wasn't just kind of a no-name brand that you just, you know, would sell on Amazon in a category where brand doesn't really matter. But then we hired intentionally. So we hired in February of that year, we hired a manager for Instagram, a manager for Facebook, a manager for Pinterest, and a manager for email. We were very intentional of we wanted a single person to own each of those channels and build out the content and build that community, interact with customers, create the conversation. And then at the same time, layered on ads and started spending just heavily and testing ad creative and audiences and just scaled that spend along with content. I think you have to have the content. So I still get asked like, hey, how do you scale? I don't think you, at least in my mind, you can't do it without the content. And we just created really relevant content and it was really easy to hire because these were customers already. We found out early on when we posted the, you know, job openings, we would get floods of applicants and it was customers who just loved the brand and were in that stage of life. So it was really easy to create that relationship, that conversation with her, the customer.
And I mean, that's a lot of people to hire, especially early on in. Not early on, but not, you know, super mature. What was your guys' approach to hiring and growing? Because you were bootstrapped, which has challenges. You're trying to finance inventory that's growing quickly, which we'd like to get into in a minute here. So that's sucking cash. Was your philosophy, let's just keep investing as much as possible to get this as big as possible. And we know that in the future, we can kind of slow down growth and we'll see the profitability there and or sell, which of course panned out beautifully. Were you just investing every available dollar into growing? How did you balance growth versus profitability? How did you think about that in the early days? Because it sounds like you just were investing very heavily, reporting everything back into the growth of the business.
We did. We took a nominal salary, enough to live on. We didn't pay ourselves a lot. And everything went back into the company. And I think hiring, we did a fairly, you know, in retrospect, a fairly good job of looking ahead at what we needed and just hiring ahead, you know, 3 to 6 months ahead, seeing like, oh, we need this. And that, right, we wouldn't be where we are today if it wasn't for team members. I think hiring is like the one, certainly one of the key skills, if not the one key skill I think you have to have recruiting and hiring if you're going to grow a company rapidly and have a highly successful, you know, outcome. I just don't see it without team members. It seems like so often other companies struggle and I think it's around hiring. So I think we also really developed a muscle around hiring and screening and that whole process and hiring ahead. So we knew it would be, you know, it would either put us at break even. We didn't ever go into a loss, but it was certainly quite thin as far as margins.
What gave you the conviction to do that? Or what was the end game for you? Because I think for a lot of bootstrappers, myself included, like it's, you worry that if you, you know, you spend too much on it, it's, you know, you may never get that back, or maybe not even that so much, but you just, you see that the road to being able to see a large team pay off is it's a long road, right? Like, cause you build, there's a book called No Man's Land that I've read, kind of, you know, you've got to, there's a lot of investment in people to be able to almost create, you almost have to hire ahead of the curve to build a team that supports the organization that doesn't exist yet. So did you just have a very clear vision that, hey, we're in this, we want to get this as big as possible, we're going to build the infrastructure now, we're going to hire as much as and invest as much as possible because we know it's going to pay off when we get to that 15, 20, 25, 30 million level? Was it very intentional, or were you guys just more the mentality of, hey, let's just invest as much as we need to make this a success and the money will come in the future?
It was intentional.
I think that coincides with the first vivid vision we created. There was definitely, there was a number in it that said we were going to be a team of, I think it said 30 in that first vivid vision. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it was intentional, and it was looking ahead. And Garrett's a lot better than I am about looking ahead and, you know, knowing what's going to be coming down the line. And it does take a bit of faith. Obviously, you have to have enough cash to make it work. And I don't think we ever, you know, got out of, you know, a healthy ratio of, you know, revenue to what we were paying in payroll. But there were a few times where it felt like, oh, well, and here's what would happen. We would go through an interview round hiring for one position, but there would be like three or four great candidates, and we didn't really maybe need them yet. But a fast growing business is going to have a spot for them within a few months. And so there were a couple times where we took a leap and hired a little bit ahead because there was somebody that we just really needed to create a position for. Like our director of operational effectiveness right now, she's a great example. She interviewed for a customer care position because she just really liked our brand. And this was back in March of 2017. And we thought, well, she's not right for this position, but man, I really like that person. And when you're just kind of, you know, building out a company, you have that liberty of maybe they don't have to fit the exact position you were interviewing for. But when you come across quality people, you can hire a little bit ahead and really, you know, sort of influence the overall org chart with some fantastic people.
And we did have our org chart outlined ahead of time with blanks in it. So we knew where we were going. We knew we were hiring ahead of the curve, and I think that made us more comfortable doing it. But it has always been about the people, to Deanne's point. If we thought somebody was amazing, we would find a role for them.
And we could do an entire episode on this, but if you guys had to pinpoint one or two of the top things, that, because it sounds like hiring is something you guys do exceptionally well, what do you look for or obsess over? Like, I think every culture or every company has kind of the things that are really important. And like, for me, when I'm hiring, like, someone who's really detail oriented is something that is incredibly important to me. What are there one or two of those things? What are the one or two must haves you guys have when you're looking for people?
People must be self-motivated and able to essentially work without, not always, you know, direct supervision, but people that are just highly motivated, people that, you know, get shit done.
How do you screen for that? Do you guys have a way or some kind of, you know, test? I mean, how do you screen for that? It seems hard to screen.
Yeah. So, I'll add to Deanne's. The first kind of barrier or screen for us is just cultural. So we have an intake form that really screens for across a number of items. But then the first interview is just a group interview and grouped by a group of candidates and Deanne and I. And we committed to interviewing the first 100 team members. Like early on, we were like, you know, everybody that joins our team, we're going to interview at least through the first 100 team members. And we're at 56 team members, I think, now. And then the second interview is a doing interview, what we call a doing interview. And it's just doing your job. And we're going to, as part of the interview, you're going to share your screen since we've always been remote, and we just work on a problem. And it goes very much like, I'd like to spend some time today working through a problem or a puzzle. We call everything a puzzle, not a problem. I've sent you an email. Can you please go ahead and check your email and open it up and share your screen when you're ready? And I'd like to just work through this with you. And it's only like 2 to 3 questions and a, you know, an issue or a problem. And yeah, you just really want to figure out, okay, how does this person think? How do they work? And are they technically, for us, are they technically savvy as well? And you kind of figure all those things out in a doing interview pretty quickly. And you've already figured out the cultural part in the prior interview.
And what would be an example of something, an exercise you give them? Would it be, if it's customer service, would it be, hey, log into Help Scout and, you know, here's a question that somebody has, draft up a reply to them? Or what would be an example or two of what you guys, of one of those exercises?
Customer care does have draft a reply, a couple different replies. Accounting one would be an Excel sheet that has a lot of data, and it'd be, you know, can you, you know, talk to me about which products sold the most in this month? And, you know, the data doesn't lend itself to figuring that out easily. So you quickly discover, okay, does this person know how to use Excel, and can they create pivot tables? And we'll encourage them to, you know, feel free to ask questions and think out loud. We just, you know, we're here to work together on this.
Yeah. An example in our production area, we'll ask someone to create a tech pack while we're on screen together, a very simple item. And maybe they don't get the whole thing finished in 30 minutes, but you get a really good idea of how they work on the portion that they've done so far.
And then last question for you here. We got to wrap up in a few minutes. I could talk to you guys for another hour about a lot of this stuff, unfortunately. You grew so quickly over such a short period of time. How did you guys finance your inventory with the growth that you experienced? Because I feel like that's one of the biggest challenges for companies in the e-commerce space growing, because these companies like yours just gobble cash nonstop. So how did you finance this crazy growth?
Early on, we got an SBA loan. That was 2016 even. So not even a year in. I wrote a business plan, went to the SBA, and we got an SBA loan. And then a year later, we refinanced that and got another SBA loan. And then we used, in combo with that, and later on, we used Amazon lending. And, you know, we got to one point where Amazon would lend us up to $1 million. So that helped certainly in the first 2 to 3 years. And then we got big enough where banks started being able to lend us money. So we worked with a couple of different banks, but ended up securing a line of credit and a loan from first one local bank and then subsequently another local bank.
Yeah, local banks were really our friends here. I think a lot of the bigger banks really just won't work with a small growing business. So I'm really grateful to local banks that were willing to, you know, look at our story and loan to us. Because frankly, usually by the time a bank will loan to you, you don't need it anymore.
Well, thank you so much. I can't think of two people that, you know, deserve to have such a great story and exit. And obviously it was very well deserved with all the hours and work you guys put in. So thanks for being so candid about talking about parenting and balancing that. Again, it's not something I think it's talked about very often at all, if candidly. And so I appreciate that so much. And if you're listening, kindredbravely.com, we'll link up to it in the show notes. Incredible clothing, nursing clothing for mothers. It's really beautiful, well-made stuff. Annie, my wife, has some of it and used it when our kids were younger and just raved about it. So it's, and obviously if you can't tell from the success, it's, you know, it's others think the same. So make sure to check them out. And thank you both so much for coming on and talking about this. Really, this is a fun discussion. I loved hearing your story and diving in. Yeah, congrats again on the sale of the business, and excited to see what you guys do in the future.
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, thanks, Andrew.
Thanks so much for listening. And the fact that you made it to the end of the episode tells me you're probably somewhat interested in this stuff and might be a really good fit for the e-commerce fuel community. Our community is the world's largest group of 7- and 8-figure e-commerce store owners and offers a value-packed form, dynamic live events, and much more. If that sounds interesting at all, you should learn about membership and how to apply at ecommercefuel.com. Big thank you to our two sponsors. Supercharge your email marketing efforts with Klaviyo, the world's best email and SMS marketing engine, at klaviyo.com/ECF. And also one-click upsell from Zipify Apps, where you can rapidly increase your average order value by offering powerful targeted upsells. You can get started with them at ecommercefuel.com/upsell. Finally, thanks to Sherelle Torricampo for helping produce the show. Work hard, adventure often, And I'm looking forward to seeing you again next Friday.
This is the ASY Radio Network live from New York.